You're listening to Compassion Radio. Hello, friends, and welcome to the daily travelogue of God's people. All around the world, intrepid kingdom servants find themselves in the crosshairs of spiritual crisis and warfare. And perhaps not surprisingly, they often discover they're in the presence of God at the same time. Their stories are the spiritual food we all need in times that seem starved of meaning, purpose, satisfaction, and genuine presence. Today, you're going to meet one such kingdom servant that has faced the unimaginable and encountered God's incomparable power in the midst of it. To say her story will challenge many of the preconceptions we have about how God works, who he visits, and what he's up to in this world would be a very, very big understatement. In fact, I imagine we'll get some listener response saying simply, "No, this just does not happen." Well, if that's where you find yourself, I'd simply ask you to start listening to today's interview with this question on your lips and heart. Lord, what do I need to understand about you as I listen to this program? That's it. A simple question that just might have profound implications for the future of your own thoughts, faith, and actions. I've discovered God has an interesting habit of often answering such questions. I've also discovered that he absolutely does not answer 100% of the questions I don't ask. Frankly, I'm at the point in my life where I'm tired of not hearing from God simply because I'm too afraid to ask. You might recall the Word of God has something to say about that too. And here's a hint. You'll find the answer in James 4:2. And with that, let's go to one of the most unique and powerful interviews we may have ever presented on Compassion Radio. A program note as we begin. There were a number of technical challenges recording the call, and we've done our best to edit for clarity and content. If you hear anything confusing that you'd like explained further, just email me. The email address to reach me is bramfloria@compassionradio.com. Or you can send a message through our website feedback page. I've titled this program series, From Certain Death to Brand New Life. Here's part one of that interview. An article jumped out at us that really just captured our hearts. We thought, we got to explore this further. We couldn't find much lead information on the person we're going to talk to today at that time, but we went ahead with the program, just tried to describe as best we could from the author's perspective in that article, what it was like to survive the most unimaginable kind of crisis in life, and how God showed up. Literally, in the article, they talk about how Jesus came to save. We were thrilled by that whole concept that this is a living faith. It's a reality that redeems the moment and gives us a future and a hope in a very literal sense. And Natasha Latour is exhibit A in this whole discussion about whether or not God's active in this world today. So, Natasha, I'm very happy to finally welcome you to our Compassion Radio program.
Thank you so much. It's nice to finally meet you.
Yeah. We've followed your progress on Facebook and the kind of things you've been working on. Your testimony, I use that word very judiciously. It's not just an idea of sharing something you think is important, but a testimony of God's actual redeeming work in a life and how it transforms things is what you have told us about, what you've lived out there, what you've shared with others. And it comes from the most unlikely of places. And we'll discuss that today. But recently, your testimony of how God is at work in you, it also is carrying you into a testimony of how God is sustaining you through something that millions and millions of other people could probably very much relate to. And we'll talk about that, hopefully, too, a bit over the next few minutes that we share together. First of all, if you don't mind giving me just the very small nutshell background of how you started life, the prehistory story that led you up to a very momentous encounter on a set of train tracks in California.
Sure. I was in June 25th, 1974, I was established in a place called Carmel, California. I was born at Carmel Community Hospital, and I lived the first few years of my life in Seaside, California, until my mom relocated to San Jose, California. My sister, my mom, and I, it was like that until my brother was born 12 years later and another brother 15 years after that.
The family is kind of spread out like that, too, in my own life. Yeah. So it's like having very distant brothers and sisters.
Yes.
It gives you a whole different kind of identity, too.
Yeah, yeah. My dad actually has 9 kids.
Mm.
And so, but we weren't raised, you know, we weren't really raised together, but we're still close enough, you know?
Yeah.
And my dad came from Louisiana to Stockton, which is what kind of led me to Stockton. My grandmother lived here. I'm one of, I think, 41 first cousins.
Wow.
And so it's a, yeah, it's a pretty big Creole. That's the Creole side of me.
Okay.
And it's a pretty big family. A lot of praying people, a lot of people, a lot of bishops, pastors, reverends, ministers, and people that I thought were just praying for for who knows what
Yeah.
until I found out.
But it was the kind of culture you grew up in where speaking to heaven and to earth was just part of the continuing conversation in life. And people that grow up in those kind of faith traditions really see, sometimes they see on the negative side a devil in every fence post, but others will also see God very much alive and sparkling in reality. And when you have a family that love the Lord like that and speak to you as if God is in the first person in the room with you, that sets an interesting foundation that we don't even realize is baked into us really early on in life. So how did it play out in your life?
I was actually baptized Catholic as a kindergartner, and I went to a Catholic school. I went there, I think, from kindergarten to second grade. I didn't really understand it. Don't remember any part of the rosary. I just remember standing there every morning and doing it with a little dress on. And it
Uh-huh.
was, and the word, it was very hard to understand because it was thee, thou, I mean, I don't know, I guess it's the First Testament. So
Very formal English, yeah.
as a kindergartner, you're like, you know, it's like Romeo and Juliet. Like, this is very confusing. You know what I mean? You know, we left that school and then went to public school. And then it was on my dad's side of the family, which is a whole different type of thing. It was like this Baptist Pentecostal, the Lord was everywhere and then sometimes nowhere. You know, and so I used to kind of tease my grandmother. I'd walk out of her house, out of her bathroom, and I'd see her in this little rocking chair, little old black woman in her bedroom. And I'd pass up her room and then go back and say, "Grandmother, you're still praying?" And then she'd look and she smiled and she'd you know, giggle a little bit. I pray for my children's children's children. And
One
it never
generation
hit
to the
me.
next.
Yes, you know, and it never hit me until those were the first words, Bram, that I heard once I was shot, was her voice, and it said, "I
Wow.
pray for my children's children's children." And I'm like, "What?" You know, like, wow.
And yeah, we
So,
just set kind of ice water in the ears of our listeners right then because you just mentioned being shot, and we're going to get to
oh,
that
sorry about that.
encounter. Well, it's fine. I don't mind getting ahead of the story. I just want people to be so shocked that, I'm sorry, she said what? This is a seminal event in your life, and it's more than just getting shot like a street crime or something. It's way deeper than that. But tell it your way, girl.
Okay, I moved around a little bit. I don't have any children. There was never a very strong, significant relationship in my life to where I thought about settling down and having children. You know, I'm gay. I lived in San Francisco. I lived in Santa Cruz. I lived all over, done all different types of things. And later on in life, I say later on in life because most people, I think I'm learning that they usually start to play with drugs, like teenage years and stuff like that. It
Usually,
wasn't
yeah.
until I was about 20 years old.
Okay.
By this time, my mom already had 10 years of sobriety, so I grew up actually going to the AA meetings with her, and I learned all the 12 steps and all the 12 traditions, and you know that was never affect me. And then I started to dabble in drugs, and the responsibilities, all I had to do was take care of myself. So I ended up doing a drug called methamphetamine, and that's a really cheap drug, and it's so cheap that all you have to do is literally you can recycle and get what it is that you use. It's not like crack, like you're not selling your body, but it consume you. One day turns into three, turns into four, and you turn around and it's a year later. And when you surround yourself around everybody who's doing that, then we're all doing it and it's all normal.
I would assume that most people have a general understanding that methamphetamines and the precursors, the chemicals that are the base for that drug, are why we now have to be signing over our information when just ordering Sudafed over the counter from the pharmacy. But it's basic drugs that have been part of our culture for a lot of years were found to be great feedstocks to things that would overamp your entire nervous system and give you an incredible rush and a high. So that's why meth was created and they found they could actually cook it up in kettles and houses. And in fact, there's a house in my own neighborhood here in Spokane, Washington, right now that got shut down for a meth lab. It's
Dangerous,
everywhere.
dangerous situation.
And
It's definitely everywhere, and I think Hitler used it as well.
I'm sure he did. So it's easy and it's cheap, and it's something you can keep pushing until you finally just break down. People will go all the way to the point where they're losing hair, losing teeth, those kind of things, because the
And
body.
it's also shared, Bram. It's also
Yeah.
it's one of the drugs that it's like kind of like marijuana at Woodstock. Nobody's greedy with meth. It's you know, everybody's, oh hey, like it's a stranger, hey, you want to smoke? And you know, and there you are. And 1 hour turns into the next hour, turns into the next hour, and it's like, oh man, you know, and so your schedule is now it's crazy, you know.
Did you ever get to the point while you were using before the crisis in your life that happened to be with this violence? Before that time, did you ever get to a point where you felt like, I've gone too far? I really do know I'm stuck. I have a problem.
Oh, of course. There's times where you sit there and you're like, you know, God, I want to live. I don't want to die.
Okay.
You know, unfortunately, going back to that praying family and everything and things that you hear, there's all kinds of God is for everybody else, but he may not be for me because I'm doing these things or I'm, you know what I mean? Like, you know,
That God wants the good people.
yeah, he may not be listening to me. So I'd sit there and, hey, I want to live. The people around you that are doing math with you, they're thinking the same thing. Not everybody, but like, man, I'm so tired of this. We don't want to do this anymore. I want to live. You get this warm, fuzzy feeling, and it's like, not now. I just bought this. You know what I mean? It's just like, it's this
Okay.
whole, that kind of thing comes into play.
Can I sidebar you for 1 second about the issue what might have brought you to it in the first place? Having been
Sure.
brought up around a couple of different faith traditions in Louisiana, being a cultural and a family root, I smell the place. I lived in Tennessee and traveled through Mississippi and Louisiana many, many years. There's just a certain sense of place that no place else on earth that I've ever been is like than Louisiana. And there's a richness and a greenness and a muddiness to the entire place. So it's full in your senses.
Yeah.
So that's in you. But you also mentioned earlier in our conversation that you're gay.
Yes.
And I wonder, coming through your adolescent years and coming to terms with what you believe to be absolutely true about the way God made you, is contributing to the sense of alienation, or that you were getting driven away from the faith families that you could have leaned on to get through this chapter in life where the temptations are strong and you're trying to find your place in the world. Is it something that drove you away from the faith during that time that brought you close to people who made the drugs more acceptable to you, or something else that happened in your life that said, I'm going to try this?
Well, so I tried it because it was fun. It was like, it was, I mean, I remember being, it was a fun situation that turned out not to be so fun anymore. But with regards to the faith, like, I mean, I knew that my family, besides my mom, because I mean, it's my mother, you know what I mean? And my dad was very accepting of me being gay, but he wasn't really in my life, you know what I mean? My dad's family, it was like, they love me, they accept me, but you're not going to bring your girlfriend over here type of thing. And a lot of people preaching the word definitely made me not want to go towards the church. You know what I mean? There's been plenty of churches that I've walked into, one look, and it's like all of a sudden, the whole sermon is about how we shouldn't be race mixing and homosexuals. And I'm like, okay, well, so maybe that happened because I walked in. I don't know. It was a constant, yeah, this is not for me. This is not for me. It's almost like some people will make it seem that Jesus is not available for you because you are doing this, this, and this.
I am certain, Natasha, that there are plenty of folks that are trained in a tradition theologically that are deterministic that way, that they really truly believe that sexuality itself, that doesn't fit the constraints of what they see as acceptable and coherent for their life and their place on this planet, has to be in some way sin because they can't relate to it at all. And therefore, it has to
Yes.
be an abomination on every level and
Yeah.
not seeing a person in front of them. I mean, I think we're at that point in our generations right now where we're facing that crux of, are we going to admit that people that see themselves as gay and are going to stay steady in that identity, are we going to stay with our judgment of that issue, or are we going to see a person in front of us and grapple with the reality that Jesus dealt with people? That's
Yes.
a big question our generation we're dealing with right now. And I am not taking sides whenever trying to make a point about the issue of homosexuality. I just know that you're there. And I know from your own story that in the middle of this, you encountered Jesus, the real Jesus. And that's
Blew my
why,
mind.
yeah. And it's going to blow
Blew
our
my
minds as
mind.
listeners, because I'm sure there are people that are listening to this program right now that are absolutely convinced that God cannot talk to someone, quote, like you.
Okay, and I was almost convinced of that until Bram, I was dying. I got
Lord.
stuck for about 20 years.
That's not a small time.
And in fact, in the original, and your wife told it so beautifully, it's important to note that people may look at me and say, oh, well, it wasn't that bad for her. She still has her teeth. And, after I was injured, you start to do things when you become sober, like go to the doctor and go do checkups and things like that. And so I've had these since May a year. I was sober for about a year. It took that long to get the fittings and everything else, and I have it to be like this.
And you have a great smile now. So
Thank
you
you
have
so
a set
much.
of teeth, which is, of course, we have to admit that those appearance things are not truly us. They're not our soul, but they do
Correct.
reflect to what we're trying to present to the world, correct?
They do. They do.
And they also reflect on how we see ourselves, because we do see ourselves as creatures that have an outside and an inside and an eternal and a temporal, if we really think about it. So your teeth to me are kind of a testament to you deciding that your body was worth saving and that you deserved better than to have to walk around not able to chew. I mean, something as fundamental as that.
Well, you know that, and honestly, you know, if you're walking around with missing teeth, then you people are talking to you like you have a stain on your shirt,
Yeah.
regardless of what you're saying. I remember, you know, there's gonna be my, like, you know, like just like when I got sober, I was in a motel room when I got sober, and I was looking at the news, and this individual, his house was shot up with a paintball gun. And the police were there, the news was there, and that frustrated me to no end because I was in a situation where nobody was investigating. And so I fell to the floor, and all I was talking to at that point in time was just Jesus. That was I said, you know, I'm not going to survive and do the things that you want me to do if I'm on drugs. I'll die. And I said, so please remove the very desire. And Bram, I've been effortlessly sober ever since then, and that was May 1st, 2021. I don't go to meetings. I don't go. And I'm not saying they're bad for anybody. So my mom got sober and she loves it. She swears by it. For me, I got sober with the Lord. He restored me. And he kept on telling me, I just rest, relax. I'm preparing you for something. And then the teeth came. And then the job came. Everything just started to fall in place. And you know what happens next. So I ended up being presentable to have this conversation and to have this smile and everything. And it's just like, so yeah, glory to God, then I get the sobriety and the humor. Thank
Okay, and you got plenty of that now. I'm glad you do, Natasha.
you.
Okay, so let me get this timeline straight then. God found you because you called him. You asked him for help directly, and you expected him to actually answer personally. Natasha, you're talking right now about how God is restoring your bits and pieces and parts and making you wholer and wholer again
Yes.
over time. And that's a beautiful story in itself. But it also came after a chapter where the worst that could happen to a human being happened, and someone literally tried to murder you.
Yes.
So can you move the clock back to that chapter now?
Yes. So it's mid-pandemic. It is April in 2021. Girlfriend at the time, we'd been together for 9 years, and her mother was in her mid-70s and terrified of the pandemic. We see on the news that there's just
Yes.
people, you know, body bags, and she just thinks that if you walk outside of the door, you're going to bring the COVID back, and we're all going to die. During a conversation that her mother was having on the phone, I heard her mention that we needed bread. I went out to get bread for the household, and when I came back, I was homeless because she thought I had the coronavirus.
The mother just assumed you had the virus because you stepped outside.
She was that terrified of it.
So you step out in the middle of COVID trying to go get bread because the family has nothing to eat or whatever. And you come back, and now you have a terrified old woman who's certain because you breathe the air outside the house, you now have COVID.
Yeah, I could possibly be bringing it back in. We didn't fight about that. I just went and got a storage unit. I put my clothes and things like that in the storage unit so I can kind of treat it like a closet.
Got it. Okay.
And I had already been recycling. At that point in time, EDD came out. Now, when you recycle, it's kind of like you're an independent contractor. So I was able to get the EDD funds, which was able to supplement your income. Plus, I claimed a friend of mine, a truck driver, and then someone else was a home health aide. So their jobs, they had to go to work, and I cleaned their house, and I'd shower there and sometimes stay in the garage. So I was homeless on that level.
Wow.
And so this is mid-pandemic, towards the end of my addiction. I would soon find out later. I leave my storage unit, and I think I had to check out of there at like 6 p.m. I went and borrowed my friend's bicycle because that's when you recycle at nighttime. You know, the people put their trash
Yeah,
out, and then you go get the
right.
cans. And in the morning, you're okay to go ahead and turn them in. I'm by the train tracks. It's about 3:30 in the morning. And the train's coming, so I'm barricaded in, Bram. The train on one side of me, and then there is about a 12-foot wrought iron fence with tons of foliage going over it. And I'm right there by the rocks and the train tracks. And I hear kind of like the gravel, you know, the rocks that are by every train track.
That 2-inch gravel surface were really sharp. Yeah.
Yeah. And there's an individual standing there with a mask on. And that wasn't weird because I had one on too. And in fact, we're all supposed to wear them. That wasn't scary. It was like, okay, there's somebody standing there with a mask and a gun. And so I said, you know, what the fuck, you know? By, and the wind is going by, and then there's muzzle flash. That's all I see is muzzle flash. There's no word
Oof.
exchange. There's no nothing. And I just start getting hit. I don't know why this is happening. I know it's a mistake because I didn't do anything to deserve it. Or I felt like it was a mistake. Like, this is they got the wrong person. And then next thing, the end of the train has gone by. The wind has stopped. It's quiet. The person is no longer there, or I don't know if they're there or not. I went towards the shooter, but people have to understand that the street was where the shooter was. If I was going to live, I had to get towards the street. I couldn't turn around And then he would have access to my back, and there was nowhere to go. If I went towards the inside of those train tracks, there's a half a mile worth of field, and they would have found my body there easily.
So let me capitalize this again. You describe a situation where, because of your work you were able to do in order to get some money together to support yourself, it's the middle of the night,
yeah.
and you're on the train tracks, you're pinned by an active train going by, there's only one way out, and that's now blocked by somebody who's blazing away at you with a gun. And in the video that I'm watching of us doing this Zoom call, you're indicating you're getting struck across your chest, even up by your neck or something. How many times were you hit, and where in the body did this man actually hit you?
I was hit between 8 and 10 times. The reason why I say between 8 and 10 times is because there's a graze on my arm. And I don't know if that bullet also went in. When the nurses and doctors tell you that they removed bullets, Bram, they may not be full bullets.
Right.
So the holes on my body, there's approximately 9 holes, including the graze, is 10.
Okay.
There's no exit wounds.
Not at all.
And I wasn't hit anywhere below the waist.
And the lead they were able to get out of you, were they able to extract every single piece of metal?
No.
Okay.
No. If you were to look at the night sky and you see the shrapnel, my x-rays have those little bright, shiny, they're in there. However, about a year after I was shot, a year and a half, I had a bullet removed from my side. That goes to pathology. This bullet, about 2 months after I was shot, it came out of my clavicle.
The bone itself.
Correct. And I have that piece here. I tried to turn it into police, but they didn't believe it came out of me. So it'll be a necklace at some point in time.
And way to celebrate survival right there.
Yeah, yeah. We thought there was a bullet under my left breast, but it turned out to be bone fragment from a bullet. I mean, the rest is there. They don't like to just go and dig into your nerves if they think it's going to cause more damage. And maybe it'll make its way to the surface. Maybe it won't. But the way that God makes our body, it's crazy because it actually goes away from our organs. You know what I mean? So during that shooting, I broke my clavicle, my liver was lacerated, and it punctured my lung. I was shot between 8 and 10 times. I'm really not sure because of that graze, if it went in or not.
So when you come to, the life situation that you're in has to be understanding that you've already been having some conversations with God about life, the universe, and everything. You're beginning to grapple with your mortality just from the drugs. And deciding that you wanted a better path, or at least beginning to ask him in the first person, what's going on? Can I get out of this? So now you're facing someone who is, for whatever reason, decided to end your life right there, if at all possible, and gave it his best go.
Correct.
And your only way out is a crawl toward where he might be right around the corner, for all you know.
Correct.
But that, you know, it's the only way out. And I assume you're probably not just jogging down to the end of the block, look around. You're probably crawling at this point.
Let me rewind a little bit. When I pull into the train tracks, I'm going to smoke a cigarette. Yep. And I may or may not have plans to do drugs. I don't know, but I know that I have them in my pocket. And mind you, unbeknownst to me, this shooter had just killed somebody in Oakland about 2 hours before.
He's probably raging on drugs himself, for all you know.
I have no idea, but this shooting, it's the third shooting. The second shooting of the same day, but just a few days earlier, he killed his first victim.
Wow.
So I am what makes it a serial killer, this shooting. I pulled in, Bram, and I put my bike down. I took my backpack off. And after I was shot, there was no time to pretend like you're dead. You know you're shot. You know, I crawled on my back, actually scooting with one leg, because when I was on my stomach, all I can feel was wetness.
Yeah, I'll bet.
Both my grandmothers are passed away. And like I told you, the first thing I heard was I pray for my children's children's children. And then I was instructed by these two voices. I never saw them. You know what your grandmother sounds like?
Yeah, I remember
and
her.
It was like boot camp. It was like boot camp. You know, move, girl, move. And I remember telling my mom's mom, why? And she said, I'll tell you when you can rest. Move. And so I got to the street. And I'm thinking, what am I here for? What did they get me to the street for? Because my grandmothers were no longer there with me. And I get to the street and I'm calling for help. I'm calling anybody and everybody. Yeah. Somebody please help. It's Tasha. I've been shot. I've been shot. I'm waving my arms around. Like I said, mid-pandemic, I'm on a one-way. There is one trauma center in the city of Stockton and it's 15 minutes away if you speed. And my phone, Bram, is in that backpack that I took off over there by that bike.
You're not going back and get that one at that point.
No, I used every bit of energy that I had to get to the street. And I remember thinking to myself, I'm going to get to these railroad tracks because I'd rather let this train hit me than to let this person come back and kill me. And God, I hope that somebody doesn't hit me and they think that they killed me because I was already shot. I didn't want a car to hit me. So I got to where, you know, when you have the railroad tracks, they're kind of up like this. And then there's like a little bit of a slope.
Right.
I got on top of that so I would be able to be seen. And I'm waving my arms and I'm saying, anybody, somebody, please, please help me. And it's all silent. It's all eerie, you know. And then I remember that I had that one last call and I'll just give it a shot. And I said, you know, God, I'm dying. I laugh now because I'm like he didn't know, you know what I mean? And then boom, here comes Jesus. I never saw him either. But when he appeared, his presence, I said, it's you. And he said, yes. And I said, will you please sit down here with me? And he said, yes. I told him, I'm dying. Please don't let my mom find my body here. And then he got behind me and my body was laid back into his. And he put his arms around me. And at this point in time, I'm in so much excruciating pain because the adrenaline's gone. There's nothing else. It's just like now that you're soaking in, I could barely breathe. One of the bullets I found out later had been in my lung. There's blood coming out of my mouth. And when he put his arms around me, all the pain was gone.
Wow.
All the pain was gone. It was the last time I heard my grandmother's voice. She said, well done. It felt so good that I was hoping that I was going with him.
We're just getting started with this incredible interview with our special guest, Natasha Latour. I hope you'll tune in tomorrow for the next important segment in the series. And if you missed anything today, just find the podcast streaming at our website, CompassionRadio.com.
Our toll-free number is 1-800-868-2478. Our mailing address is P.O. Box 77160, Corona, California, 92877. We'll see you tomorrow.